Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Violence in Nigeria takes the lives of dozens. Tanzania denies reports of Chinese smuggling. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. An explosion at an ATM in northeastern Nigeria has killed at least 8 people and injured many more. A police spokesman says the blast went off today in the town of Azare in Bauchi State. A witness tells VOA the bombs were planted on 2 motorcycles near a bank where the ATM was located. Earlier, at least 16 civilians and dozens of militants were reported dead in the same region after a battle between soldiers and the Islamist group Boko Haram. The AFP reports that the governor of Nigeria's state of Adamawa has called for troops to help prevent the advance of Islamist forces. Governor Bala Ngilari told reporters that 5 local governments have been overrun by Boko Haram militants in his state. He said military intervention is needed to stop the advance that apparently has gone mostly unchallenged. Ngilari also called for a soft power strategy to try to reach out to Boko Haram foot soldiers, most of whom live among the population. The government of Tanzania is denying reports that Chinese officials bought illegal ivory while on an official visit. The nation's foreign minister says reports of a British environmentalist agency are a fabrication. Those reports claimed that Chinese officials had smuggled ivory out of the country during a state visit by President Xi Jinping last year. Almost all ivory sales in most places of the world were banned in 1989. This is VOA News. The AFP News Service reports that the West African bloc ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, is calling for international help in fighting the Ebola virus. Current ECOWAS chairman John Dramani Mahama, also Ghana's president, said today that international help needs to go beyond the obvious and tangible needs presented by the disease. ECOWAS says the region will need help in caring for the orphaned children of parents who have died of Ebola. It also pointed to the long-term economic impact of the disease. ECOWAS is also weighing in on threatened sanctions in another issue. The AFP reports that the regional bloc has come out against putting sanctions on Burkina Faso due to the crisis sparked there by the removal from office of longtime leader Blaise Compaoré. The African Union Wednesday gave Burkina Faso 2 weeks to transition from military rule to an interim civilian government or face sanctions. ECOWAS Chairman John Dramani Mahama visited Ouagadougou this week to help in mediation efforts in that country. AFP reports South Africa has signed a nuclear energy agreement with China. The energy ministry says it is committed to boosting power generation by 9.6 kilowatts by 2030. South Africa has signed other agreements with Russia and France. Lawyers for South African athlete Oscar Pistorius say they will oppose the government's appeal of Pistorius's 5-year manslaughter sentence. The Blade Runner, as he's called, was given a 5-year jail sentence for killing his girlfriend, a sentence a group of prosecutors called shockingly light and inappropriate. Reuters reports Somalian Prime Minister Abdiwelle Sheikh Ahmed will face a no-confidence vote next week. Legislator Dahir Amin Jassaw told the news service today that Western donors helping to rebuild Somalia are frustrated over political infighting in the country. He also complained about what he called the prime minister's lack of respect for the constitution. He said his motion is backed by 140 lawmakers, was presented to the speaker on Thursday, and will be debated November 15th. AFP reports that Sudan's president and main rebel leader held talks for a second day today in Addis Ababa. Regional leaders have been putting pressure on the warring parties to end the civil war in that country. The UN Security Council is concerned, threatening sanctions if the fighting continues. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes are down at this hour. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
We will come to the end of this crisis. The message from our administrator now is to say that we need to throw absolutely everything at it, and that this will be a very important lesson learned for the future. The important is to keep these countries going so that they can get back on their feet.
That's Nicolas Douyer, spokesman for the UN Development Program. He talks about the importance of continued investment in Ebola-affected countries. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the new military leader of Burkina Faso dismissed an African Union demand to return the country to civilian control within 2 weeks. And violence continues in northeast Nigeria, where Boko Haram continues a 5-year campaign to create an Islamic state.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization has released updated figures on the Ebola outbreak. It says 13,268 cases have been reported in 8 affected countries since the outbreak began, and 4,960 reported deaths. In other Ebola-related news, manufacturers of personal protection suits have increased their production for use by health workers battling the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. However, some health officials are now worried that equipment demand in the United States and other countries may delay distribution of the suits in the 3 African countries where the virus has already killed an estimated 4,800 people. A spokesman for DuPont in St. Louis said they have tripled production of suits and are giving high priority to West Africa request by the World Health Organization, Doctors Without Borders, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The International Association of Firefighters has asked President Barack Obama for more money for fire departments to train and equip first responders and to urge manufacturers to increase production of the gear. Consumer demand has also risen on eBay, where gear sales jumped from $50,000 a month to $250,000 in a matter of weeks. In Accra, Ghana, West African leaders appointed Togo President Faure Gnassingbé to lead regional efforts to fight the epidemic. They met yesterday for their 3rd meeting since the crisis began to discuss strategies. Ghana President John Mahama said although some countries had made progress in stabilizing the epidemic, more needs to be done. Mr. Mahama said Ebola is still a serious matter.
Besides the human cost, the Ebola epidemic is rapidly draining national budgets in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The UN Development Program says the crisis has caused a slowdown in tourism, mining, and trade. The UNDP describes the Ebola outbreak as one of the most complex developmental challenges in recent times, imposing a serious stress on the fiscal capacity of governments. Its new report says expenses in the 3 worst affected countries have risen by 30% and that governments are not able to operate at pre-crisis levels because of nearly $330 million budget shortfall. What's more, they could become more dependent on international aid as both domestic and foreign debt grows. Nicolas Douyer is a spokesman for the UN Development Program. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the economic impact of Ebola.
It's been pretty serious, we can already say. The crisis has already resulted in reduced economic activity in a variety of sectors, and it has certainly started to affect people's livelihoods and ability to cope in this difficult time.
How have the governments in West Africa, the countries that have been affected by Ebola, been trying to cope with this economic setback?
They've been trying to send the message out, basically, that economic activity needs to continue. Because if you cease working and investing in the economy, you're basically creating a crisis which will continue well beyond the present emergency. I mean, we've been saying that the crisis in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia could last up to 10 years after the last case has been solved.
Why 10 years?
It's a broad estimate, but it's just to let people know that this isn't just a matter of a few months and that we can get back to normal right after the crisis.
Can you look at the individual countries and indicate how this economic impact of Ebola has affected certain programs or projects that have been planned.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can tell you that in general, for instance, the government of Guinea, because of reduced tax and increased spending on the crisis, has reported a shortfall of $220 million, which will basically affect economic activity and investment in basic social services across the board. When you look at investments in infrastructure specifically, for instance, there's $20 million for Liberia, which are not going to be invested in infrastructure, and that number for Sierra Leone is $16 million.
So what happens to these governments now? Are they forced to borrow more money or seek more international aid?
Absolutely. What they're doing is they're turning to the IMF and the World Bank for additional funds. And of course, you know, this is a situation that is not encouraging because these countries were beginning to grow economically, capitalizing on their peace and democratic transitions, and they were starting to, from their increased economic activity, raise extra revenue and to become more autonomous. So they're now at risk of increasing their dependency on international funding.
So you've issued this warning, but can anything be done?
Yes, I think the message to the international community needs to be that while we deal with the emergency, we absolutely need to continue investing in the economies of those countries. There are pregnant mothers who are not getting attended to because the medical services are completely overstretched. In Sierra Leone, only 2,000 of the 10,000 HIV-positive patients who are normally on antiretroviral are still able to get their treatment. So the message needs to be that we need to continue to invest in the long term, and this will be the best way to avoid another crisis like this one in the future.
Who would the main investors be?
Some of the investors in countries like Sierra Leone are mining companies. There are Canadian companies, U.S., Chinese, and Japanese are there as well. In Liberia, about 50% of the concessions for palm oil or mining are reported reduced activity or just have ground at a complete standstill. These companies have a role to play in making sure that their employees are still there, that they're still keeping people active, that they can make a living out of their activity. We will come to the end of this crisis. The message from our administrator now is to say that we need to throw absolutely everything at it and that this will be a very important lesson learned for the future. The important is to keep these countries going so that they can get back on their feet.
Nicolas Douye is a spokesman for the UN Development Program. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa.
Coming up on 13 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The new military leader of Burkina Faso dismissed an African Union demand to return the country to civilian control within 2 weeks. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Yakuba Zida said he was not afraid of any sanctions threatened during an AU meeting in Addis Ababa earlier in the week. The presidents of three countries in the Economic Community of Western States, ECOWAS, met with Zida on Wednesday. They urged the nation to move forward with planned popular elections next November. The leader of the ECOWAS mediators, Senegal's president Macky Sall, continued talks with Zida and political opposition to identify an interim administration of civilian leaders. Diplomats said today all sides had agreed to a year-long civilian leadership. President John Dramani Mahama of Ghana said he thought they would agree on interim civilian leadership in the next few days. The army took power over the weekend when 27-year President Blaise Compaoré resigned after large crowds of protesters burned the parliament. Compaoré had asked lawmakers to revise the constitution so he could run for another 5-year term.
Violence continues in northeast Nigeria, where Boko Haram continues a 5-year campaign to create an Islamic State. A suspected suicide bomber killed 8 customers at a branch of the First Bank of Nigeria in the town of Azari in Bauchi State. Local reporters said those who died were lined up at an automatic teller machine outside the bank. Yesterday, suspected Boko Haram fighters in 6 pickup trucks raided a cement factory in Gombe State and seized dynamite from the company's quarry. Factory officials said after the intrusion, no employees were injured or property destroyed. Residents of the town of Potsikum have demanded an investigation into the cause of death of 18 local men arrested by Nigerian military as suspected Boko Haram rebels on Wednesday. Potsikum is the commercial center of Yobe State.
A nurse told the French news agency uniformed soldiers delivered the 18 bodies to a local hospital today with signs of wounds caused by knives and bullets. Community elders told media they believe the men were targeted by Nigerian security because they were members of the Kanuri ethnic group, which are often recruited by Boko Haram militants. 4 days ago, a suicide bomber killed dozens of Shia Muslims celebrating Ashura, a religious holiday in Potiskum. In Malam Fatori town, 16 civilians were reported killed and dozens of militants dead after a fierce 12-hour clash between Nigerian security and Boko Haram. Malam Fatori is about 200 kilometers from the Borno state capital, Maiduguri. The army was reportedly aided by troops from Chad, Niger, and Cameroon who were stationed at a nearby multinational barracks.
Somalia's political leaders are at loggerheads once again over the reorganization of the cabinet, prompting a warning from the United Nations to focus on building credible institutions to move the country forward. Analysts say the next year will be crucial for solidifying Somalia's recent gains after decades of lawlessness. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
The controversial began Monday when UN envoy to Somalia Nicholas Kay said he was concerned about allegations that lawmakers were being bribed in exchange for votes to ouster the prime minister. In a statement, Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud acknowledged the UN's concern, but called for the international community to respect Somalia's right to determine its own future and allow Somali leaders to solve their differences. The political bickering between the President and Prime Minister Abdiwali Sheikh Ahmed began 2 weeks ago after the Premier made a cabinet reshuffle. Among those affected was the President's close ally and Minister of Livestock and Husbandry, Farah Sheikh Abdul Qadir. The President termed the changes null and void, setting off an increasingly public dispute between the two leaders and their supporters in the Parliament. This is the kind of division that has plagued Somali politics for years, but Somali lawmaker and former constitution minister Abdirahman Hosh says it is good for Somali leaders to wrangle, calling it part of democratic process. He adds ultimately the politicians must settle their disputes. Top leaders, political wrangling is a good thing for us. Leaders who agree on everything is not good for the country. The politics itself is about people with different views coming together, but when there is division, then a solution has to be found to solve the differences. Some political observers have blamed the Somali constitution for continuous infighting between presidents and prime ministers. James Smith is an independent analyst who tells VOA that clashes between the two leaders are almost a certainty.
It speaks of a broader problem with the constitutional sort of makeup of the executive. But at the same time, it's the lines between these two individuals, the responsibilities and authorities of these two individuals is so blurred that actually, you know, infighting is almost to be expected.
The current Somali government marked its second year in power a month ago, a very long term of political stability by Somali standards. Smith notes whichever way this latest infighting ends, the government is running out of time to build credible institutions and prepare for elections in 2016.
I'm quietly optimistic that this will be resolved without a collapse of the cabinet, without a replacement of the prime minister. I think there's an awareness that patience is running out amongst international circles, despite some of the rhetoric that's been coming out against them recently. And I think there's an awareness that, you know, people's patience, the donors' patience, is running out, and that another 3 month process to find a new prime minister is going to frustrate a lot of people.
Hosh agrees the government has many other problems on its plate and cannot afford to lose more time to internal politics. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A A primary school education program in Ethiopia has received a $1.6 million boost to keep it going. SOS Children's Villages, the world's largest organization for orphaned and abandoned children, announced that it received the grant from the Leona M. and Harry B. Hemsley Charitable Trust. SOS Children's Villages says the money will fund its EduCare program that focuses on providing vulnerable children and their families with vital service to increase grade level completion rates in the city of Bahir Dar. Lynn Kronberger is CEO of SOS Children's Villages USA. She spoke with me about the challenges Ethiopian children face to stay in school.
Children in Ethiopia, as well as their families, are still experiencing a large amount of poverty. And when families are put in stressful situations, a lot of times the older children need to quit school and go to work and support their families. So what we're seeing still in Ethiopia is a lot of sibling heads of households or youth heads of households where their parents are no longer there. And often these children need to take care of the rest of their family. So what we're hoping to do with EduCare is provide additional resources to these children at risk of dropping out and give them extra support so that they can stay in school. And not only the children themselves, but then the community around them, like the schools and their parents, so that they can take care of these kids and let the kids finish school so they can start to break this cycle.
Is the dropout rate, how does it compare between boys and girls?
That's a good question. When I was visiting this program, when we interviewed children who had been through a similar project, it was equal boys and girls.
And what would be the age range?
Most of these are youth, 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old children. So they've hopefully been through early education, but now is the real risky time when they're being looked at to provide an income for their families. So it's youth and older children.
In looking at this dropout rate, what are some of the challenges or even dangers of child labor?
When these kids have to drop out of school and try and find an income, a lot of working environments aren't safe for children. They put themselves at risk. They put their families at additional risk. They have to find different types of housing. They're not able to provide food for their families. And obviously the wages aren't well controlled and safety measures aren't in fact for children. So keeping them in school is the safest way to ensure that they can grow up healthy, continue to be safe, and then most importantly, set themselves up for a life with an education and a better opportunity at a better job.
How do communities benefit from primary school education?
In addition to providing the youth with a stipend and money for school supplies and food, we're also going to be providing services to the schools so that the schools can support these kids. A lot of these schools are also struggling. They don't have a lot of money for the materials that they need for homework, for making it easier for kids to be able to study. So we'll be supporting the schools themselves as well. That obviously will benefit the community and be a resource for the community. And then also making sure that we help families. So if we can provide income-generating activities, microfinance support to the families, not only does that help their individual family, but it helps the community around them.
Do you all provide the training for the teachers right there?
We do. We have train-the-trainer models where we're working with teachers not only to make sure that they're providing good educational support, but so that they can learn to identify children at risk of dropping out. Because if a teacher comes up to a child and says, you know, I know things are really tough for you at home, what can I do to help you? What kind of help do you need? If we can intervene before that child disappears into the workforce, we have a better chance of keeping them in school.
What is an example of a success story that you can share with us?
I was able to visit this program in February this year and met a young boy named Iosa. He actually wasn't that young, and I was there actually with the funders. He was still in school, and he was actually tutoring younger kids, so Iosa was a very smart young man. And when we asked him how old he was, he said, I don't know, because there's nobody in his life right now who was there when he was born, and he has no idea technically how old he was, which just hit home for me because these children are really abandoned. They don't have anybody around them to take care of them. And he also had two younger sisters that he was having to take care of. So with this EduCare program, we were able to provide him the assistance he needed to be able to stay in school, to continue to support his siblings, but not at sacrificing his own education.
That was Lynn Kronberger, CEO of SOS Children's Villages USA. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
The International Organization for Migration reports there has been an alarming increase in the number of women making the dangerous crossing of the Mediterranean Sea. IOM says the sharpest rise is among young women from Nigeria. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The Mediterranean Sea crossing from North Africa to Europe is considered to be the deadliest route for migrants in the world. Amnesty International estimates a record number of more than 2,500 migrants died trying to make this crossing during the first 9 months of this year. Despite the dangerous sea conditions, migrants continue to risk their lives in an effort to reach Europe. Figures from the Italian Ministry of the Interior show more than 154,000 migrants have arrived in Italy this year. Most come from Syria, Eritrea, Mali, Nigeria, Gambia, the Palestinian territories, and Somalia. The Geneva-based International Organization for Migration says a worrying new trend is the growing presence of women among the usual migrant flow. It says 16,839 female migrants have arrived in Italy this year, more than double the 7,658 who arrived during the same period in 2013. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says about 1,300 Nigerian women migrated this year compared to just under 400 this time last year. He says most come from Edo State in western Nigeria, and many are believed to be potential victims of trafficking.
According to the IOM teams that are debriefing them when they arrive in the ports in Italy, many are complaining of being raped or trafficked as sex workers. During their journey, they're immediately trafficked into sex trade, including in brothels in Libya, where they're forced to pay off their transit fees. And then we assume that continues in Europe as well.
IOM has established two anti-trafficking teams in Sicily and Apulia, whose job it is to detect and identify victims of exploitation. Millman tells VOA many young women know the smugglers who have lured them with false promises into making the journey. He says they soon discover the traffickers have lied to them.
We know that some of those women are told they owe debts. There's even talk of voodoo ceremonies being conducted, and they feel that some supernatural force will punish them if they don't pay. And part of the therapy that IOM's been doing in Europe is explaining to women who are terrified that they should have no fear of this voodoo oath that they submitted to in Africa that obligates them to pay these smugglers.
Millman says a number of the Nigerian women have identified their traffickers to IOM staff who debrief them when they arrived in Italy. He says some of these traffickers have been arrested. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is a public is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Hello. I want to take a few moments to speak directly to you, the people of West Africa. On behalf of the American people, I want you to know that our prayers are with those of you who have lost loved ones during this terrible outbreak of Ebola. Along with our partners around the world, the United States is working with your governments to help stop this disease. Stopping this disease won't be easy, but we know how to do it. Together, we can treat those who are sick with respect and dignity. We can save lives, and our countries can work together to improve public health so this kind of outbreak doesn't happen again. In this urgent work, and in building a stronger and more prosperous Africa, you'll continue to have a partner in me and in the United States of America.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The new military leader of Burkina Faso dismisses an African Union demand to return the country to civilian control within 2 weeks. And violence continues in northeast Nigeria, where Boko Haram continues a 5-year campaign to create an Islamic state. Coming up, music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, schooling disrupted for millions of students in Sierra Leone because of the ongoing Ebola crisis. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off today with African Athletics.
Kim, our starting line on the Sunny Side of Sports is African Athletics. Some of Kenya's top distance runners will be challenged Sunday morning during the Athens Marathon. So tough is the course that it's unlikely any major records will be achieved in the Greek capital. But it offers a race rich in history, both ancient and modern, as we hear now from the energetic Andy Edwards in Athens.
The legend of the origins of the marathon is well known. How a Greek soldier named Pheidippides is supposed to have run back to Athens from the plain of Marathon, bringing news of the defeat of the invading Persians. That took place over 2,500 years ago, but a far more recent history maker could have an effect on the outcome of the women's race.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
For the past 5 years, the former world record holder in the marathon has helped last year's women's champion Joan Rotich with advice. She is part of a training group in Kenya's Ngong Hills who benefit from Paul Tergat's wisdom every morning. He's there 7 days a week giving instructions for the morning training and then easy jogging in the evening. The advice paid off last year as Rotich won in tough conditions at a time just outside 2 hours 41. Now her best is considerably faster, 2 hours 31 minutes and 56 seconds, set in finishing second in the Munster Marathon in Germany in September last year. Paul Tergat's final advice was that she was fitter than ever and capable of breaking the 2.5-hour barrier, which would be a women's course record. If Joan Rotich is the favourite to retain her title among the women, the men's race looks more open. Hilary Yego is the defending champion, but he's run 3 marathons so far this year, and the hilly Athens course will test his stamina. Another former champion is Raymond Bett, the event record holder with 2:11:35 2 years ago. Another to watch is David Ruto. One of his training partners, Bernard Kitour, was among the pacemakers who helped Dennis Kimeto break the marathon world record in Berlin 6 weeks ago. Ruto says he's been matching Kitour stride for stride in training and has high expectations for the race on Sunday. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Andy Edwards in Athens.
Elsewhere in African athletics, Kenya's newly crowned New York City Marathon champion says he plans to reclaim the world record in 2015. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma has that story, as well as news about the commissioning Friday of a sports stadium in Akwa Ibom State, Nigeria.
Kenya's former world marathon record holder Wilson Kipsang has vowed to set a new world record next year. Kipsang told the Nairobi media on return from his triumph at the New York City Marathon that he has his sights focused on setting the world record at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China next year. Kipsang's world record of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 23 seconds was erased by his compatriot Dennis Kipruto Kimeto at the Berlin Marathon in Germany in September. Kimeto's record stands at 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds. A Nigeria Super Eagles outfit composed of home-based players host Ghana's under-23 side, the Black Meteors, in a friendly to mark the commissioning of the newly constructed Akwa Ibom International Stadium in Uyo, Akwa Ibom State. According to media reports in Lagos, three heads of state, President John Mahama of Ghana, Ivory Coast's Alassane Ouattara, and Nigeria's Goodluck Jonathan, are expected to grace the match at this 30,000-seater stadium. The event will also be used to test run preparations for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifier between African champions Nigeria Super Eagles and the rapidly improving South African Bafana Bafana.
And shine, Bafana Bafana, arise and shine. Let your victory be enshrined in the great annals of soccer. Tackle them and leave them dizzy. Tackle them and leave them mesmerized. Shine, Bafana Bafana, shine. Hola, Bafana Bafana. Hola, Bafana Bafana. Bafana Bafana. Bafana Bafana.
Basketball news now on the VOA. The Houston Rockets are off to an explosive start early in the NBA season. On Thursday night, the Rockets easily beat their Texas State rival, the defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs, 98-81, to improve their record to a perfect 6-0. Playing at home in Houston, the Rockets were led by center Dwight Howard, who scored 32 points and grabbed 16 rebounds. Howard dominated near the basket, with the Spurs missing two of their key big men, Tim Duncan and Tiago Splitter. San Antonio's Argentine star Manu Ginobili also was held out of the game for rest one night after hitting two key free throws to lift the Spurs to a 94-92 victory over the Atlanta Hawks. James Harden added 20 points, 6 rebounds, and 6 assists for the Rockets, who have the NBA's top record with 6 wins and no losses. The Spurs, meanwhile, lost for the second time after 2 victories. The league's 2 other unbeaten clubs are the Memphis Grizzlies and the Golden State Warriors, who have 5 and 4 wins, respectively.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
Hi, I'm Shegun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Just ahead, VOA's Downtown Brown will have our English Premier League football question of the week.
Hey, it's VOA's Downtown Brown, and it's a great day to talk about soccer this week. We had the most responses so far, and I thank you for that. The question was, do you think Southampton Saints will finish among the top four clubs and qualify for the UEFA Champions League? This week, we have three winners. One of them is Alabi Adekunle Ibn Jamo from Nigeria, who said, the Saints of Southampton are a very good team. They're always play as a real team. Their fate depends on how well their manager can handle injuries and red cards. They will sure make the top four this season. I will not be surprised if Southampton wins the league coming May 2015. Francis Malcolm Kamanga, who said, the English Premier League has just begun. They said a good beginning has a bad ending, and this is very true. As far as underdog team goes, Southampton are considered. They are usually perform the worst, especially during the second round fixtures. Let's wait and see. And last but not least, the third winner is Amadola Modamari from Nigeria, who said, never. I cannot see them making the top four. They're second because they have not played the likes of Chelsea, Man U, Man City, and Arsenal. The two matches they lost this season are against Liverpool and Tottenham. By the time they play these hard clubs, they will not be in second again. Thank you guys for leaving me all these comments. I had a blast going through them. Let's try to get to 100 comments next week. Matches to watch over the weekend: Liverpool versus Chelsea, Southampton versus Leicester City, Man City versus the Queen Park Rangers. And check your local listings for the time. Top injuries from Arsenal: Mikel Arteta is out with a hamstring injury, and his return date is November 24th. Jack Wilshere will return this week from his illness. Oliver Gerrard and Matthew Debushi are both returning December 21st. For Manchester United, Falcao still does not have a return date with his calf/shin injury. For Manchester City, Vincent Kompany should return this week. David Silva will return November 30th. Soccer rumors: Arsenal is planning on signing Mats Hummels, who is the World Cup German defender. Did Chelsea give $24 million to Barcelona defender Gerard Piqué? Steven Gerrard from Liverpool might sign with New York Cosmos. Manchester City has interest in signing Marco Reus, a German wing who also was played on the World Cup German team. I'm VOA's Downtown Brown, and that's the sunny side of sports.
Thank you, Downtown Brown, with that latest English Premier League football question of the week. Getting back to the Saints of Southampton, even if they don't finish among the top four and qualify for the UEFA Champions League, the Saints have clearly been blessed, yes, blessed, with a good start in the EPL. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a photo of me wearing my new Nigerian dashiki, a gift from Dr. Larry Zamajay and my friends at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM in Nigeria, our Voice of America broadcasting partner. Dr. Larry has Brilla stations in Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, schools disrupted for millions of students in Sierra Leone because of the ongoing Ebola crisis. And next, we focus on artists and the upcoming Francophone Summit. But first, some music. Here is DXD of Ghana with Life Juju.
It don't blow my mind, so man, I'm panting. Let's wipe from Asheville to Compton. When I'm ready, she don't do me no long thing.
She don't give it to me till I'm dropping. Emily and daughter, I'm bluffing. When we are together, we're not flopping. She has a breaking news, I'm reporting.
I like that. DJ, put the rewind on that track. She do me wrong, I'm running right back. Blame myself, I love it like that. Like juju, feel like juju. She be my boo-boo, hey. She be my boo-boo.
don't need promotion to sell like Gary.
Gary.
To the bar, take two shots and fly with me all the way to Paris. Don't change your style, don't change your style, just be like that for me.
Yeah, don't change your style, don't change your style.
Don't change your style, don't change your style, just be like that for me. Love it when you fling that thing on me. Love it when you put it all up on me. Love it when you throw that booty on me. Booty on me, booty on me. Beauty queen, girl, you find me, oh. I can't stop asking why me, oh. They keep asking why me, oh. Why me, oh, why me, oh.
DXD of Ghana with Like Juju.
Well, more than a million children in Sierra Leone have seen their schooling disrupted because of the ongoing Ebola crisis. To make up for lost school time, classes are now being broadcast on 41 radio stations and the country's only TV channel 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Nina DeVries reports from Freetown, the country's capital.
Some examples of animals include man, and the word man is a general term.
Doris Ansumana takes notes now from her radio classes in Freetown. It's a big change for the 17-year-old who's used to the daily routine of going to school. Since the Ebola crisis, things have become boring, she says.
I was watching television. I was going out to my friend, play. After that, tonight, we watch some movies.
Doris says so far she's enjoying the radio lessons, but she says other youth don't always have the resources.
Some of them do not have the opportunity to sit down and write because some of them live with their aunts, their uncle. So during the morning's hour, they go and sell.
Her guardian, Yabonet Sese, keeps an eye on Doris to make sure she does her work. She, too, is concerned about other young students, as many can be forced into doing labor instead of studying.
Some of them selling for their living. They don't have money. So at least if the government's extending at night, because everybody at night stays at home, don't go anywhere.
Brahma Michael Touré is the deputy director for the Ministry of Education, Science and Technology, the body in charge of the initiative. He says the point is to have the lessons during normal school hours between 11 a.m. and 5 p.m., He says the ministry worked hard at getting teachers' input and have recruited 30 of them to help with putting the broadcast together. They're all qualified to teach for different levels. He argues parents must realize this is for their children's future and the ministry cannot constantly monitor them.
This has to be one of their greatest responsibilities. We can provide the service as a ministry, but if the parents who are at home do not participate, this is going to be a fruitless endeavor.
I want you to remember that all the examples we have named.
The broadcasts are coordinated by the Sierra Leone Association of Journalists and the Independent Radio Network. Several international partners such as UNICEF are working with the ministry too. Core subjects like math, science, and English are covered. There's also a psychosocial component to remind children, especially orphans, that they're not alone in this Ebola crisis, says Touré.
And then really actually instilling a sense of hope in them and letting them know that all is not lost. And also, in fact, doing the same sensitization of, okay, wash your hands, do this, do that, so you don't end up losing your life or losing a family member.
Children at the Ben Hirsch Interim Child Center in Kenema in eastern Sierra Leone are a prime example of those directly affected by Ebola. The center is a place they can go after they've lost their parents to the deadly disease. The experience is traumatizing, made worse by the stigma that children sometimes face from relatives. But the radio programs are helping, says Vandy Puji, a staff member there. He says employees are also playing their part to make sure children listen.
When the time reached for them to listen to the radio, we got them in, tune the radio so that they can get the questions. And during the listening hours, we draw our own questions through the radio. So after the whole exercise, we ask them, what did you understand? What did you learn?
The ministry will continue to roll out more programs and also has plans to bring solar-powered radios in the coming months to very remote areas of the country where there is no electricity. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown.
French-speaking countries and their leaders from around the world will gather in Dakar next month for the 15th Le Francophonie Summit. 30 heads of state attended the most recent summit, and artists in Senegal are taking the opportunity to make their voices heard. Danser Les Arts is a week-long artist's residency that is being held in conjunction with the summit to highlight dancers, graffiti artists, and fashion designers from Senegal. Sarah Marinkani, creative director for the event, talks to Ricky Shryok about why the arts deserve a seat at the table during this global event.
Artists are human living, so they are in the society, and they need to show what they do. It's not just an artistic event. We have to know that they live in the society, and it can have an impact on the politic, on the economic, on the social life of a country. And it's very important for me to be on this big event, which reunites a lot of presidents and institutions. And I think that the artists have their place there.
What kind of dances will you be featuring during the summit?
There is a lot of different dance because we have six dancers. We have two who is very traditional practice. There is another one who is a breaker, so very hip-hop. Another one who is like contemporary. But they all can do a lot of dance. That was very important for us to have dancers who can practice different kind of dance.
Do you think it's important to have, as you mentioned, traditional, I'm guessing, West African dance at the Francophonie Summit because there are more, in fact, Africans who speak French than French?
Yeah, this is very important to show the traditional things because we are in Africa, but we speak French. And as you said, there is a lot of French spoken in Africa. So we need to show that even if we speak French, we all have our culture, and to show these different cultures.
And you mentioned having an impact in society as artists with so many presidents here. Is there any specific message that you're hoping to convey with this event to these presidents who are here?
Just to show that we exist, that we have to consider art and the culture, and we have to show what we create here, and to show that it's important to have art in the society, that he can bring you to have nice relationships with everyone, with the population, and to create an atmosphere, a nice atmosphere, instead of always thinking about tourism or I don't know what they want to put money in and not very in the culture and artistic. And I think it's very bad because it can help a society to be a better society.
Also, especially here in Senegal, the arts often have an impact in politics. The rappers or the graffiti artists often have political messages. So do you think that always be something you'll focus on too, is the relationship between politics and art that is so close here in Senegal, maybe more than other places.
Yeah, there is a lot of rapper and graffer who wants to show what they think about politics through their art. For me, it's not really like that, because I think, we have to show that the relationships between art and politics. But for this first project, it's just to have a nice week to create.
That was Sarah Morinkani, creative director of Danser Les Arts. She was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Dakar, Senegal. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child on the Involvement of Children in Armed Conflict prohibits using anyone under 18 to take direct part in hostilities. Recruiting and using children under the age of 15 as soldiers is defined as a war crime by the International Criminal Court. Still, around the world, 250,000 to 300,000 children are unlawfully recruited to participate in armed conflicts. 6 years ago, the United States enacted the Child Soldier Prevention Act, which requires the Secretary of State to compile and publish a list of countries that recruit or use child soldiers in their military forces or support groups that do. These countries then face legal restrictions on access to certain types of U.S. military assistance and training. But when a country takes significant positive steps and works to improve the situation, and it is in our national interest, the United States can fully or partially waive sanctions to provide an incentive for reform and may continue to work closely with those governments to end the unlawful use of child soldiers. 9 countries were listed this year. Syria, Burma, and Sudan did not take significant steps to prevent recruitment of children and will not receive a waiver. The Democratic Republic of Congo and the Transitional Government of the Central African Republic are making progress to reduce the recruitment and use of child soldiers. They received partial waivers, so has South Sudan, but for a different reason, to enable a ceasefire monitoring and verification mission and to continue efforts to counter the Lord's Resistance Army. Otherwise, the U.S. government suspended nearly all security assistance to South Sudan in early 2014. Rwanda ceased support of the M23 rebel group, which recruited and used child soldiers. Somalia has made some progress and needs help to fight against terrorist groups, while Yemen signed a UN action plan to end the recruitment and use of child soldiers. These 3 countries received full waivers. The waiver doesn't mean that they are not guilty of recruiting child soldiers. To the contrary, said Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Michael Kozak. It means they are. And therefore, the sanction and the law would apply, but for the waivers. The goal, said Ambassador Kozak, is not to punish countries for their bad behavior, but to persuade them to change it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story. putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.